Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. Today we celebrate the feast of Our Lady's Assumption into Heaven with a special reflection in her honour. We also look at the way in which Benedictine monks are also human spirits in search of the divine. First, however, we continue with our journey, accompanying those who travelled from freedom in Africa to slavery on the other side of the world.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, alone words from home, alone words from
Then we came to a huge wedding. I had never seen anything like it before, but all I could look at were the strange pale men with their metal sticks. I thought that maybe they were there to help us, but their violent ways and rough language soon told me different. Many days later, when the pale men came to move us from the strange wedding, some of the others looked pleased. I could not be happy, no matter how bad things were in that place, with its heat and dirt and death. I was right to feel bad. I had seen the water when we had arrived and had heard it moving some nights, but I could not imagine it could be so big. They pushed us into wooden boats that I thought were huge until I saw an even larger boat out in the water. I don't know if it was the water or the sight of a big boat, but one of my people jumped. I was too weak to try. Some of the pale men laughed, leaving him for a moment before they pulled him from the water. He looked very sick.
I can hardly tell you what happened next. They took my clothes and touched me and looked at me. When I tried to cover myself, they grabbed my wrists. I cried with anger and they laughed. For 3 days, those same white men watched as I crouched in a corner of that building with barely enough food or water. Others, men who were sick and beaten, sat around me and were told of what we knew. One man thought the white people would eat us. I promised to make them sick if they ate me. Of the fourth day, they opened the gates and we were moved out. I was so glad to be out of there that I willingly walked to one of their boats. It took us to a ship like those I had seen before, and that it is where you find me now.
The worst time of my life was in the despair of that stinking, black, silent hole with hundreds of men and boys. Then a white man picked me. Cassie, my wife, used to say, "I have a proud face. I think it had helped me here." This man looks different to others, cleaner with different, finer clothes. He seems to be a kind of doctor and I don't recognize his methods or tools. I am careful not to anger him.
The Industrial Revolution was the period when the slave trade reached a peak. Huge numbers of slaves were transported to the cotton fields of America's southern states in order to satisfy the ever-increasing demand for cotton yarn and materials. The conditions in the cotton mills, especially in the north of England, were appalling and were themselves akin to slavery. There was, however, a slight difference between the mill workers in England and the slaves on the cotton plantations. Tony Tipples, keeper of the Merseyside Maritime Museum in Liverpool, explains.
The conditions in the mills were pretty unpleasant, yes, very noisy, very difficult. But there is a difference, I think, in that although you may be in awful conditions, it's not quite the same as not having any freedoms and being totally belonging, totally dependent on somebody else, having no rights. At least, you know, they did have some rights.
The lack of human rights experienced by the slaves as they travelled to America is described by the people themselves.
and now I'm in the blackness of that huge boat. I didn't imagine that men could make such a place, not even the pale men. My head still hurts. Every muscle aches from crouching in this tiny space, and the metal rings on my ankles and wrists bite into my skin. I'm so scared that my body rebels against everything I eat or drink. A man near to me. I didn't understand his words. He couldn't eat, so the pale man took him out through the hole in the roof. We think they put hot rocks to his mouth. Now his lips are so burnt he cannot speak or eat. I must try to eat.
At first there was much room in the space under the floor, yet we were chained together. We soon found out why. Through the holes in the walls we could see the coasts, and sometimes the ship stopped to collect more people like us. Very soon there was no room to move with so many women and children. Then the land disappeared as we moved in the direction of the setting sun. Then the crying and the heat and the smell got worse. Sometimes we were taken outside to exercise, but there was always white men staring with their guns pointed at us. At night they get noisy and take some women away. The women always return crying. I don't want to imagine what happens to them. Last night there was a storm. I had never been so close to death or so scared. Yet I would happily fall to the bottom of this ocean if it would take me away from these white men and what they plan for us. Some of the children were clinging to me. I must try to help them, although they may be better dead as well.
Days have passed and I am grateful to this man. I am in the sunshine. I help him clean and heal the people still in the hole. They have dirty sores under their metal rings, wounds from weeping, and many cannot eat or drink. They get so thin. I think many will die before we see land, even some of the white men. Today, I wish to be in the hole with the other people. White men are demons, and I fear I am less Asante being near them. They spit and kick and whip children and women, sometimes each other. Then, they even threw a newborn baby into the water. I stopped his mother following him, and then we sat and cried.
Tony Tibbles also speaks of the conditions on board the slave ships.
It was pretty awful. The men were separated from the women and children. They were generally shackled. They would have been very closely held together, probably having about 18 inches of space. And, you know, it would be hot and humid. The stench was appalling. I mean, it's said that you could smell a slave ship coming from miles around. And the food was quite poor and monotonous. Basically, things like beans, yams. Water was obviously a very important element. But it was also a situation in which disease easily spread. So that mortality on board these ships was quite high. Certainly in the early days, something like one in five of the enslaved were dying on the voyage. Now, particularly as the 18th century went on, there were some attempts to try and alleviate that situation. And later in the century, certainly on British ships, you had to have a surgeon on board.
When Pope John Paul II went to Senegal in February 1992, he was deeply moved when he visited Gorée, the place from where slaves were collected and dispatched across the ocean.
Oui, en même temps que ma joie, je vous fais part de ma vive émotion. Gorée, symbole de la venue de l'évangile de liberté, et aussi, hélas, le symbole de l'effroyable égarement de ceux qui ont réduit en esclavage des frères et des sœurs auxquels était destiné l'évangile des libertés. Mais en venant en Gorée, où l'on aimerait pouvoir se livrer entièrement à la joie de l'action.
Allow me to express my conflicting emotions at visiting this African shrine of black sorrow. It is the emotion that one naturally experiences in a place like this, so profoundly marked by the inconsistencies of the human heart, the scene of an eternal struggle between light and darkness, between good and evil, between grace and sin. Gorée, the symbol of the coming of the gospel of freedom, is also, unfortunately, the symbol of the appalling madness of those who reduced into slavery the brothers and sisters to whom the gospel of freedom was destined. In all truth and humility, this sin of man against man, this sin of man against God, must be confessed.
Il convient que soit confessé en toute vérité et humilité ces péchés de l'homme contre l'homme, ces péchés de l'homme contre Dieu, qu'il est long le chemin que la famille humaine doit parcourir avant que ses membres apprennent à se regarder et à se respecter l'image de Dieu pour s'aimer enfin en fils et fille du même Père céleste.
Like a motherless child, sometimes I feel like a motherless child, alone words from home.
And now we move into the cloisters of a Benedictine community with Abbot Edmund Power.
Fundamentally, the monk is, and the monk is in a certain sense an archetype, one could say, that the human spirit in search of the divine. You could say every human being is touched in one way or another by that tendency. I mean, there's lots of people who say that there is no God, but there must be very few who are not touched in some way by things bigger than themselves, you know, things beautiful, things that evoke something within them. So the monastic spirit is the spirit that longs for God and seeks God.
The longing for God has led monks throughout the centuries to seek quiet, lonely places in order to listen to God more attentively.
The normal way, or the very common natural way to do that, is in prayer, which is the communication or the attempt to communicate or be in the presence of this divine reality. Now, very often that requires, for example, quite concrete things like stillness and silence. And those are things that maybe are not very easily found in the context of the city. So monks have often gone into the wilds, originally into the deserts, but also into the countryside, into the mountains, because these places, with their silence, with their grandeur, can actually touch the human spirit and provide the suitable context in which the heart can call to God and hear God.
Even in a busy city monastery such as St. Paul's outside the walls in Rome, the monks still find silence for prayer. Abbot Edmund Power, the abbot of St. Paul's, explains.
We at St. Paul's, we're stuck in the middle of the city, which is fine. You know, we're a big traffic island now, but we were outside the city when the monastery was built. It was sort of in the countryside. But even in a city monastery, you know, it just means that you establish your silence and your solitude, in a way, within the walls. Because fundamentally, there's external silence, but external silence serves the development of internal silence. And internal silence is helped by external, but isn't totally dependent on it. So I think any human being, a man or woman, in whatever context, a city or country, could gradually find that silence within themselves, which is the context where they find God.
The late Cardinal Hume, himself a Benedictine monk, remarked that it is all right to say that work is prayer, provided there is also prayer that has nothing to do with work. Abbot Edmund comments,
"That's an interesting way of looking at it. People say traditionally the Benedictine motto is ora et lavora, pray and work. And I think that St. Benedict never actually says that explicitly, but there's a truth in it, because his vision of the Benedictine life is a life of prayer, certainly, but a life also of service, work and service of the brethren, of your brothers or sisters in community, and then also of people who come, you know, the guests, the poor, all those who come to the monastery, because it always, traditionally, the monastery has always become a centre of a region, you know, people come to it. But I suppose people could go to one extreme and say, in fact, what you show your love of God by your love of others. In other words, your work for others is your prayer.
But work must not be allowed to take priority. We all need time alone with God.
It's true that a lot of people are very activist, you know, they do things, they want to be at it all the time, working away. And there's some monks like that as well, who are very, very active, workaholics. But the spirit, the human spirit, needs to soar as well. It needs to rise and to have the perspective on everything, you know, and then the work is lifted as well. I mean, the work can become just a kind of drudgery. You can lose yourself in service of others, which is in effect a real losing yourself, not losing yourself to find your real identity, which is what Christ speaks about, but losing yourself and losing, and that's it. So, you know, it really, the work needs to be motivated and rooted in the prayer. So I think, yeah, my humble opinion, Cardinal Hume was probably right.
Another comment made by Cardinal Hume was that St. Francis of Assisi would have driven a Benedictine community mad. There is a big difference between the Benedictine and Franciscan ways of looking at the concept of community, as Abbot Edmund explains.
The Benedictine model is that people come together, inspired by the same vision, the same search for God, and root themselves in an area of the world and make that world, that area, creative. In other words, the work, like farming or whatever, you actually mould your environment so that it becomes a reflection of God's creation and a context in which God can be found. So Benedictines have developed farming and all the rest of it, you know, and stable work within a context. Now, obviously, this way of working generates wealth. It's natural. If you work steadily and disciplined way in one area and you're not nomads, you know, you generate wealth. And so Benedictines became landowners, became quite wealthy collectively. St. Francis comes along, young and enthusiastic, wants to throw off everything, literally. Remember the incident where he strips off his clothes in Assisi. He wants a life of complete renunciation. And so he starts off all inspired. But is it possible? It's only possible because of Benedictines. Now, I'm talking in a symbolic way. It's because there is stable, organized prosperity that people can reject it and be supported by it because they're mendicants. I mean, if they go and beg, who are they begging from? Those who are working stably and creating the wealth. If everybody did what Francis did, everybody would die. If everybody did what Benedict did, everybody would live. Now, I'm not saying Benedict's charism is more important than Francis's, because I think Francis has something very important to say to people who can become too rooted in their stability and their economic security. And it's a temptation sometimes for Benedictines. So they need, in a sense, the prophetic voice of Francis sort of saying, you know, oh, this doesn't matter.
Yet the early Franciscans themselves found that they needed some structures to their community living.
There was a brother Elias, was there not, who was one of the immediate successors or followers of Francis, who wanted to sort of organise things, you know, be far more organised. And this kind of conflict between the freedom of the poor man, the little poor man, and the desire to, in a sense, institutionalise, Benedictinise the Franciscan experience. And, of course, if the Franciscan charism is to be carried on into the world, it has to find institutional forms in which to incarnate itself, you know, that Franciscans don't wander around on walking down the highways and byways begging now, like they might have done in the medieval period. They have to adapt.
Yet, however different their charisms and way of life might be, one thing totally unites every Benedictine and every Franciscan. That is, the realization at the deepest levels of their beings that God is everything. Finally, we celebrate the Feast of the Assumption by reflecting on the meaning of today's feast. Mary was assumed body and soul into heaven. This is an article of our Catholic faith. This is what we are celebrating on the Feast of the Assumption. Father Richard Taylor, a New Testament scholar who teaches at the Pontifical Beda College and at the Angelicum University here in Rome, explains the meaning of Our Lady's Assumption into heaven.
Well, it's so old, it's an older tradition than the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception, even though people had accepted, as you know, that Our Lady had died. It was repugnant to Christian sensitivity that, in fact, the person who had been the mother of the Son of God in all his purity and goodness should somehow or other have gone back to dust. That didn't seem, in Christian sensibility, to be the right thing to do. So therefore, that what pertained with regard to her Son, who was resurrected from the dead, should also pertain with regard to her who had been responsible for his mortal presence in the world, for bringing him into the world. So, obviously, it's making a major statement about the nature of humanity. What, therefore, humanity is, it means that a person, body and soul, in all the integrity and unity that that implies, is totally and absolutely saved and absolutely with God. So, therefore, the Assumption was a way of understanding that salvation had been given totally to Mary, and to articulate that in its fullness would have meant necessarily saying that she was there body and soul in the totality of her personhood with her Son. So that seems never to have been a problem with regard to the primitive Christian community as it understood Our Lady with regard to her Son. Now, across the centuries, of course, this grew and grew. And worth mentioning, by the way, that Napoleon, as you know, wasn't famous for being a Catholic, was born on the Feast of the Assumption. And so that is the reason, in France, that the Assumption is a national holiday. And when you, therefore, take a place like France, which is famous for separation of church and state, you still find the Assumption is the day in France when, effectively, they are celebrating, shall we say, their national holiday. I also think there are other aspects about the Assumption that are immensely attractive. When we talk about salvation, it's an abstract word. Or when we talk about the Assumption, again, it's an abstract word. But we shouldn't think that way. We should talk about a person, somehow living relationally. And then if we are talking about Our Lady living relationally, who was she in the greatest relationship with? Well, obviously, with her Son. And if we find total truth and goodness and beauty in her Son, we would surely expect that we would find participation in that truth, beauty and goodness in his mother. So to think of a woman expressing herself in her individuality as Mary of Nazareth then the assumption is a way of seeing here the articulation of the fullness of her being in all her splendour with her son.
Which is a beautiful way of looking at it, isn't it?
So, in other words, we should obviously think of Our Lady as being totally and absolutely happy in her relationship with her son in an ultimate and unsurpassable way. And that's basically how we should think about it, not as an abstract notion, but as I say, as a human being exercising her personality in its total fullness.
But does this teaching mean that our Blessed Mother did not die?
There are at least three claimants for her tomb, shall we say. You've mentioned the Dormition, Mount Sion in Jerusalem. And then you have also in the valley of the Cedron, you've also got a commemoration of her having actually been interred there. And then we mustn't forget Ephesus, because you see the tradition was that she had lived with the beloved apostle, disciple in Ephesus. So what's interesting is that the church didn't have, I'm talking about the church now, as believers relating with Our Lady as being eternally with her son in the fullness of her being. They never seem to have much worry about her dying. And when the dogma of the Assumption was proclaimed, that was left open, because the Assumption dogma in 1950, it just said when the days of her earthly life were over. And it doesn't say how they were over, except that having been over, she was effectively in the fullness of her humanity with her son. So that's something healthy about it, that what we're talking about here is that Our Lady was born the way other people come into this world, and that she brought her son into the world in the way that other people bring their sons into the world, and then that he left the world the way other people die, and that she herself could very well have left the world the way other people died. In other words, this is not the realm of myth. It's rather the realm of explicitation of what it is like to be loved completely, because that's what it is. In other words, the Assumption is the name that you give to being completely and absolutely loved. And that, of course, wouldn't be possible unless it involved the integrity of humanity, body and soul, in all personhood.
And that's why we celebrate the Feast
and
of the Assumption.
And that's why we're celebrating the Assumption.
And so we come to the end of our programme for today. You can hear it all again in whole or in its parts if you go to our website at www.vaticanradio.org/English. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. Until we meet again, may God bless you.
This is the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.